in the Santa Moran Alphabet Soup Club Book Club. But we're going to end the show with Summer Osmond, As I Am.
I am here. I am home. As I am. I am safe.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the 10th voice. The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
And while we're refusing to be silent, we're here to talk. My name is Philip Buell-Hooser, and I'll be your host while Elizabeth Anderson is off gallivanting around the East Coast, waving about with literary people. She is that literary maven. Hi, we're here today to talk about a book, because this second Saturday, making it the Sandra Moran Alphabet Soup Book Club, Radio Book Club. There's another, there are probably more words in there that I've left out, but who knows?
I would like three more, please.
And a few more letters.
And hello, those are my two guests. We'll be meeting them in just a moment. This is a big, big, sprawling book, so we're going to get right into it. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is about the history of American comic books, the Holocaust, World War II, American suburbia after the war, censorship, homosexuality, magic, art, family, and romance. You know, not much. although it is suffused with tragedy, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is generally a more of a comic epic, a sort of tragicomic. It's generously optimistic about the human struggle for personal liberation, and it tells a couple of love stories along the way. It was a finalist for the 2000 National Book Critics Circle Award, finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award in 2001, won the 2000 California Book Award for Fiction, and of course the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The author, Marc Chabon, I actually found the pronunciation of his name online. I hope that that's correct, because you can always trust what's on the internet. Marc Chabon's work is characterized by complex language, a lot of metaphor, along with recurring themes that include nostalgia, divorce, abandonment, fatherhood, and most notably issues of Jewish identity. He often includes gay, bisexual, and Jewish characters in his work, along with novels. He has published screenplays, children's books, comics, and newspaper serials. Wow. And here to talk about that, of course, I have two lovely guests. Hello, lovely guests.
Hello. Hello, lovely host.
Let us begin with David F. Whitner. David F. Whitner is long involved with Toastmasters, and particularly Hear Me Out Toastmasters.
Yes.
Which is a largely LGBT alphabet soup kind of group.
That's right. Out of 14,000 groups in the world dedicated to helping people to develop their public speaking and leadership skills, Hear Me Out is one of only about 20 dedicated to the LGBT community.
And if you stop by the Like Me Lighthouse on Saturday afternoons, as I often do after the show, well, by golly, you'll be able to find David there.
That's right.
Also, we have front runner, out here now film person, and librarian. One of those he does more than the other two. Brent. Hello, Brent Usher. How are you?
Well, hello, Philip. I'm doing great. It's lovely to be here. It's like old times.
It seems like old times. What else ought we to know about you? I mean, you're a reader. You're a librarian.
I am a librarian, and I occasionally read. And you mentioned frontrunners. I'm actually more of the walking type. You know, think
front
about
frontrunner
things.
Walker.
Exactly. Front walker. But yeah, I'm really, really lucky to be in the position I am in, where I get to work around people who are interested in learning and books and teaching and all these wonderful things, and I just get to show up and help make it happen. It's perfect.
Well, and I've read a lot of comic books. So, as we delve into this, I hope that people are familiar with the book. If not, you may or may not want to become involved with exploring it for yourselves. I should say, before we get into the book itself, I have tried to read this once before, earlier in this millennium, and I did not have a good go of it the first time I tried. I felt the prose occasionally was just kind of swampy and sloggy, and it was difficult for me to get through these what seemed at times endless lists of details. And right. we spoke about some of this previously. It seems like sometimes Chabon wants to show off how much research he's done by including all of it in there.
Yes. Sounds like a librarian.
Yes, and he has a wonderful vocabulary, and that caused some little speed bumps for me as well. I wanted to stop and look up words that he had used.
And very often, and sometimes some very obscure words. There was, and then doing background research on this, I also found several reviews which talked about, okay, the language in this hadn't sent me to the dictionary several times, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. Brent, how does this book start? What world are we in? What era is it?
Well, I think at the very beginning we were, it was just before, what's Germany? No, it wasn't Germany, but it was in those times.
Yes.
And suddenly there's a cousin who shows up, who he doesn't even know this cousin exists, and it's all about escaping from, what Eastern Bloc country was that?
He was from Prague.
Prague, there we go.
Yeah, he was from Prague.
And it just, suddenly there's this person in his bed, and his mom said, "Go to sleep," something like that. Remember, I listened to this book, so my details may be different because I'm also commuting as I'm listening.
That's fine. That's
I feel like
that's
I'm on the spot.
Certainly,
I'm
the
terrible.
Beginning. It's very, and it puts Sammy Clay or Sammy Clayman on the spot in the beginning, because he's now forced to share his bed with his cousin that he didn't know was coming, Yosef Cavalier.
Oh, Yosef.
Oh, Yosef. yes, he has just escaped Nazi-occupied Prague, 1939. And we learn later exactly what it took for him to escape and his relationship to escape. Part of that is one of the major things that goes on in the book, and that is escaping and escapism. Mm. And eventually the escapist. David, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, this is a term that gets thrown out a lot as, you know, positive. A lot of the time, it's a great escape to the movies, or it's an escapist adventure on audio or on the page. Both of these characters find that it's necessary to escape, sometimes literally and sometimes emotionally, in order to survive. And it's very nice to see those two characters unified behind the term and the very notion of escape.
I would almost say it's written as if every time you get into understanding exactly where you're at, you suddenly escape into a brand new point in time in a completely different story. I guess we're constantly escaping as we're reading, and that's probably why I was often lost. Like, what just happened? Why am I in a frozen place now? And why am I with a golem suddenly? And why?
Right.
It does have a lot of flashbacky kind of things.
Right.
That take you and then jumps in time.
Right. Which, at the beginning, I'm like, oh, this is very interesting. And then later, I was like, I'm a little exhausted.
And of course, at this time, we've just come off of the great fame of Harry Houdini.
Right.
The great escapologist. Yes. Who Eric Weiss, also Jewish, as Cavalier and Clayman were, who becomes a heroic figure to Josef Cavalier.
Mm-hmm.
And he studies with a magician in Prague named Kornblum, mm-hmm. In learning magic and escaping.
And lockpicking.
Yes,
lots of lockpicking.
Which helps him both escape and break into things, as eventually happens.
Yes.
So, you also mentioned the Golem, which figures prominently into the famed Golem of Prague, which was, let's see, originally created by Judah Lo ben Bezalel in the late 16th century, the rabbi of Prague, who had created this. And golems sort of figure pretty prominently in the whole idea of this, too, because they are made of clay. They are Clay Man.
Oh,
and
Clay.
Gosh, his cousin is Sam Clayman.
Oh.
And that's another thing that I wanted to discuss with you is these symbols that he sets up, like using the golem and using the name Clayman and then shortening it to Clay. And then, you know, the discovery that, the golem, oh, it's clay! It's just clay!
It's just clay.
What do you think of those uses of symbol, like escapism and escapology and the character they eventually create, the comic book character, the escapist, as the symbols and symbolism and metaphors in the narrative?
I'm fascinated by the ways in which the two characters of Sammy and Joe are opposite sides of the same coin. I was reminded a couple of days ago, as I considered the contrasts between the two, something that Chuck Jones wrote in one of his memoirs about his recollections in working with the Looney Tunes characters, that he saw Wile E. Coyote and Pepe Le Pew as being very much the same character, that they are both invested in pursuit, but one sees obstacles, whereas the other sees no obstacles. Sammy and Joe are escapists in very different ways. Joe tends to be a very literal escapist, learning to pick locks, learning to escape from locked spaces and countries and continents. And through most of the book, Sammy has to invest himself in escaping from the reality of who he is, of the reality of his own shortcomings physically and sexually, and at times even the artistic shortcomings that he's faced with, that he knows that his cousin is in many ways more talented than he is, and that he's got all of these individuals that he works with who have real power, and he is keenly and painfully aware of how he must escape those misgivings that he has about himself.
And I think that Siobhan sets these up very deliberately and very openly. He's saying, yeah, this is a metaphor right here. I'm just going to put it in your face. I'm not going to make any bones about it. I'm just going to say, here it is, and we'll make something more of it later. And indeed he does.
Well, and I would even add to that, I think in some ways he's like hitting us over the head throughout. I'm very critical, as you can tell today. But like it is very much like, here it is, and I'm going to tell you, and here I've just told you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very rich in the symbolism, but at times I was drowning in it.
I should also back up just to make sure that we're everybody's on the same page, in case you're not familiar with golems out there.
Oh, right. We didn't even talk about what a golem is.
Yes, it's a clay person, sort of made as a robot. in certain ways, that it's animated by words, much like their conversation sparks, you know, their creation of their comic book.
It's a Jewish tradition. Yes.
A Jewish tradition. There is a Yiddish and Slavic folktale of the clay boy, which is sort of a gingerbread boy kind of version of the golem. Joseph is able to escape because they have disguised the Golem of Prague, the famous golem, the most famous golem of all, probably, as a giant person, and put him in a coffin, in a casket, and he's transported across Europe and across Asia in order to help him escape.
And I would just, that to me was one of the most interesting parts of the book to me, was when there was this hidden apartment that they had to find in a building and people had forgotten that it existed to find where the golem was hidden. Mm-hmm. I thought that whole part of the book really had me hooked. I'm like, what the heck is going on right now?
Yes.
And it was pretty amazing. Also, incidentally, there is an X-Files episode that has a golem prominently played.
Also, in Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels, they use golems to do all of their work that they don't want to do. I don't really read fantasy, but I'll read every Discworld novel.
Okay.
And there's one that is absolutely beautiful that I also have to recommend while we're in the middle of this, because it's all about books. The novel Feet of Clay, which is golems have gotten together and created a super golem.
Oh, fantastic.
And I believe that this was written at the time when Terry Pratchett received his diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's. Oh. Because it goes along, and the Discworld novels are hilarious. They're just so much fun. It goes along having fun with this, and then suddenly the super golem knows that he is the only one of his kind and he has to die. Because of what could happen. And it becomes this incredible meditation on mortality for about the last quarter of the book. And it's just beautiful. So that's Sir Terry Pratchett's book, Feet, F-E-E-T, of Clay.
Oh. You'll have to post that later.
For all yes. of your problem yes. needs.
And while we're talking about things that aren't quite related,
yes.
I also just happened, I have my audio CDs here, and I see Siobhan also wrote Wonder Boys, and I actually didn't make that connection until I saw it right mm-hmm. here. And I think that is a fabulous film made from a fabulous book, so while we're at it.
I also have some notes on making a film out of this for later on.
Okay.
But you'll keep us on track?
So absolutely, because I'm going to try to go through 100 pages every 10 minutes here. So, of course, in the second section of the book, they become boy geniuses, according to the title of it. Yes. And Sammy brings in sort of the knowledge of his father, the Mighty Molecule, who traveled with the circus and performing. And he remembers that. And they break into an apartment, again, another hidden apartment they're breaking into. the Mighty Molecule, I should tell you, was the world's strongest Jew, was how he was billed.
Yes.
And so they come up with their idea of what they're going to do in creating a character called the Escapist, a comic book superhero.
Yes.
And as they do, Sam Clayman, now Sammy, and becoming Sam Clay, becomes the writer of the thing. He wanted to be an artist and also a novelist and hadn't really found it, but he seemed to blossom most with writing and creating this this comic book, The Escapist. And Joseph, now Joe Cavalier, starts off by creating this Socko cover for their first issue.
Yes.
With the Escapist punching out Adolf Hitler.
That was amazing. I mean, the imagery of how they were really sort of poking at Hitler and the Nazis, I thought was just really interesting, again, to listen to.
Yes.
David, any reactions on that?
How they handled the nuances of not wanting to upset the wrong people. And politically, politically correct.
The publishers not wanting to upset the wrong people.
Yes, not wanting to.
Because, of course, America wasn't in this war yet.
That's right. That's right. So it's very important to not to... Not to say too much and not to offend, because right. Of course we don't want to corrupt the youth and make them think that we're political and that we have opinions.
as comic book publishers,
that's right.
And this would also become a theme that that carries through in American history through the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings.
Which we touched on in this book, too, right?
And it also get touched on in this, and because there were actual hearings on comic books that they, yes. that they go to. They brought in people who were prematurely anti-fascist to,
right.
to claim that they had to be communists in the actual HUAC hearings.
Right.
And they, because they wanted to have sales in Europe, sales in Germany of films
yes.
and books and comic books in this instance.
Right.
So in that grand sweep of history, we then get, because we got to keep up with the times they are moving along in this book, it again becomes to 1940, you know, time is marching on and The Escapist becomes a great success. As it becomes a success, Joe goes off to Hoboken, I think it is, and sees a ship arriving, and for a moment he thinks he sees his father,
yes.
Presumably escaping from Europe.
Right.
And David, how do you? What's your reaction to the way that their lives, how are their lives affected, and what's your reaction to it by the success of their escapist character and then those themes of family that now get really reinforced?
Yes, well, this is something which really resonated for both of these central characters, for Joe and Sammy, the loss of a father, because
we find
mighty
out.
Molecule was a largely absent father to Sam when he was a child. It made him very aware of his shortcomings, because Sam had been diagnosed with polio when he was younger. And so being strong, being manly was important to his father, who was ultimately very largely absent. And then Joe's yearning to see his family again, to be reunited with his father in Hoboken, and the lengths that he went to be reunited with his brother. We then saw those themes of trying to build a father-son relationship resonated later in the book when Sam testifies about the controversy around superheroes and their young wards.
Mm-hmm. Yes, their sidekicks.
Their young sidekicks, and whether those, what are those dynamics? And what Sammy ultimately reconciled was that perhaps he wanted these characters, these young characters, to have these adult role models, to have these father figures. But unfortunately, he didn't get to testify to that effect. Tragically.
And also, Sammy shared something with the escapist, because in one of those flashback chapters, we get these flashback origin.
I don't mean to interrupt, but
no.
Here's what's amazing about you were reading.
I
so you had
to turn to you. So.
Well, and you can redirect in a moment. But the thing about listening to this, go to your local library. You can get it. That's a plug, I suppose. But it's not a call to action. Excuse me. But it's fascinating, as you were listening to this, or as I listened to it, you don't necessarily have any sort of cues that, like, one segment is ending and you're moving to a flashback. I assume, as you're reading visually, there's a bit of a clue? Okay.
Not much, no.
So, right, it's just very surprising.
All of a sudden, you turn the page and suddenly you're in a chapter with someone named Thomas.
Right.
And it's like, who's Thomas?
Yes.
So that's very, very fascinating. Anyway, that's all I've got to say about that.
Well, no, but I was going to say Thomas, In the flashback chapter we have into his origin, walks with a cane, and Sammy had his polio issues and was able to the first time that he steps out on stage, now being the escapist and now taking over the position, he realizes for the first time that he's without his cane. So my question for you, Mr. Brand, is with your experience of literature and reading, just in the same way that the comic books play with it a little more openly, a little more blatantly, perhaps is a better word, the way that characters become superheroes to us, or become superheroic, or are able to overcome their own limitations. How did you see that realized in this, or anything that you? Oh, you can talk about something else if you want.
I would love to. I actually don't really know how to answer that.
Okay.
That question. Because I just don't know. Maybe our other host right here, today, our other guest.
Well, something that I mentioned earlier. Thank you, Brent, for throwing the attention over to me.
You deserve it.
Something that we were spoke about briefly before we came into the studio was how superhero stories resonate for gay and lesbian individuals. For many years, I've heard people talk about how superheroes really mean a lot to gay people, because these are characters who are very powerful, but they're
ostracized.
Yes, that they're somehow elevated and they're set aside from set apart from the rest of society.
They are the other.
They are the other, and they have these great powers which they must keep secret. So they have to maintain a secret identity. One of the things that I find is very hopeful is that with the Marvel comics, even more so than when Stan Lee and his cast created the Fantastic Four back in the 1960s, fewer and fewer superheroes maintain a secret identity. So those secrets, that power that one controls, one contains, is not so secret and is more public, more pronounced, and more honest.
Well, and one of the things that I see with the superheroic identity, too, in the 60s, also Marvel created the mutants.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, and I immediately go to X-Men as I think of this conversation.
Yes. The X-Men were, as Stan Lee has said, intended to say things about race and how they were set apart and all of that, and were able to function in society, but only not completely as themselves.
I didn't know that was it, because as I watched the movies later, it felt very much about sexuality as well.
And it has evolved. I know when it comes to the publishing of the New Mutants, the new younger set of characters, there was so much about them that resonated with me as a baby gay.
Yes.
That I could say, this is...
Sorry, baby gay. I see you like with a rattler and a diaper. It's very funny. If everyone could be in the studio with us right now.
My little rainbow rattler. And, of course, Phil. My leather-studded nappy.
Can we say that, Linda?
Hasn't hit the dump button.
The role of superheroes and heroic characters in a lot of, the whole thing with the celluloid closet, too. Mm. I can't remember her name now, but the wonderful woman who says, you watch a movie just waiting for a scene where you think the character wears even a costume that you think means she's a lesbian.
Mm. Yeah, haven't we all done that?
And I think that's the narrative that we get from superheroes in a lot of ways, and probably from The Escapist as well.
And that's actually an important thing that books do and film will do, and I think it's really important. We, whatever sort of background you have, you want to see yourself represented. And if you aren't straight and white and male, sometimes it's a little harder to see yourself in much of these things. That's why this is a very interesting thing.
Yes.
Well,
and on that note,
while we're solving the world and comic books, I believe that Linda has some very important messages we hope you'll listen to. If she can get it started.
It's time for the 7th annual Permaculture Urban Garden and Farm Tour. What is the tour, you ask? And for that matter, what's permaculture? Tune in to Echo Radio KC to find out Monday at 6 p.m. right after Mother's Mix.
Pear Excellence 3, locally yours. A beer pairing with Anton's Tap Room and Cinderblock Brewing Company at Anton's Tap Room on July 21st at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. This five-course dinner will feature pairings from the chef at Anton's and the head brewer of Cinderblock, specifically paired to bring out the best aspects of each course. Locally brewed and locally grown, July 21st, this beer pairing dinner is at Anton's Tap Room at 1610 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Reserve your seat today at kkfi.org/events. All proceeds benefit 90.1 FM KKFI. Josie Records and KKFI present a Crossroads Music Fest showcase at the First Ward House in St. Joe, Missouri, July 9th at 7 p.m. This Josie Records-sponsored KKFI benefit to highlight the musicians playing the Crossroads Music Fest in September will feature Gastown Lamps. Will you be at war with yourself all the time? The Center State. Things are never so bad as you might think. Every sad storm has an ending. And Under the Big Oak Tree.
They got that local honey on which I am so sweet.
2016 Crossroads Music Fest Showcase at First Ward House in St. Joe, July 9th from 7 to 11 p.m. is a $5 donation to KKFI. $20 advance tickets went on sale on July 8th, but we will have them for $15 at this and all other CMF showcases. Learn more at cmfkc.com or kkfi.org/events.
And we are back on the 10th Voice. And I as we were talking, and the question was raised, are we sticking close enough to the book? I think that's what good books and good writing should do.
Or bad books and bad writing.
I think particularly the goal of writing is, not the golem, but the goal, is to that you bring your life into it and you bring other things in the world into it. And when a book resonates with you in that way and you're seeing it as reflected in the world and other things, it makes you think of other things, I think that's when writing does its job.
It did it.
And it's doing it.
See? And as much as I was critical at the beginning, we sure have plenty of things to talk about.
We do. Of course, things have been going fairly swell for our heroes, but now more of the tragedy begins to insert itself. They've been having their success, but Joe learns his father has died of pneumonia. And that could not have been he on getting off of the ship. Mm-hmm. And so he gets on a train for Canada to enlist in the Royal Air Force, because that way he can fight Germans, because the United States is still not in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, of course, along the way, he also breaks into the Aryan American League, which is run by a man named Ebling, who is a Nazi, essentially, working in the United States. And it will not be the last time we hear that name in this book. And in fact, he does a phony bomb threat.
Yes.
Which is... It has other consequences. It's able to lead to the idea of an escapist radio play, a radio show based on The Escapist, which then happens. Now, here's another one of the things that this book occasionally does. Because at about this time, they go to a party for Salvador Dali.
Right. Right.
They meet the architect of the Empire State Building. They go to a party. And, of course, you know, they are getting some fame. So it's tenuously believable.
But, that was another one of those moments when I said, what?
But then Salvador Dali gets trapped in a diving helmet.
As one does.
Which could happen. Maybe his mustaches got caught somehow.
Right.
And, of course, who is able to rescue him but Joe? It's not as weird as reading Ragtime, where it's like every five pages, oh, here comes another famous name. But it does occasionally happen. It's kind of believable. It's kind of set up that they right. could be in this. But I using Salvador Dali is, you should pardon the expression, surreal.
You were waiting for this, weren't you? You planned that.
It just sprang to me. So there is this big party, and of course they meet the host's daughter, whom they have met before.
Yes.
David, lead us away on talking about Rosa.
Rosa Saks. Yes, Rosa Saks had played a role in Joe Cavalier's life earlier. Well, in both of their lives, but he'd met Rosa when he had to break into the Palooka Studios, I believe it was, mm-hmm. to introduce the escapist crew to kind of bring them together. So the
scene of their first meeting and leading up to it is a very thrilling and acrobatic scene. I must say.
Yes.
And then it devolves into talking about whether or not she was wearing panties.
Yes.
It did. That
yes.
was another one of those moments when I said, what am I listening to?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
But Rosa plays a larger role in their lives, becomes sort of the third partner in the Cavalier and Clay unit.
And it's quite a significant party as well.
Yes.
Because for other reasons, not only does he save Salvador Dali's life, not only is Rosa there, but Sammy has a revelation.
Yes.
Do you remember this from...
Yes.
This
is where he first sees two men kiss.
And he thinks, oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Oh.
And it occurs to him that maybe this isn't just a mechanical behavior, but something that they might even enjoy. Something
right.
that he might even consider doing at some future date.
And not too far future.
No, not too far future.
Indeed. Because all of those themes and strings start to tie together.
Yes.
And at the same time, of course, also, here goes Joe. He's agreed to do a magic show at a bar mitzvah.
As one does.
Absolutely. As he's agreeing to do that, and he leaves this office, he sees a giant green moth on the trunk of a tree, and which is beautifully described in that scene. But it is a Luna moth, and it reminds Joe of Rosa.
Yes.
Huh. And suddenly, we're back in another one of those chapters where there's
a
whole new story going on.
Right.
And it is the origin story of a character, a comic book character that they create, named Luna Moth. Now, speaking of wonderful creatures and beautiful creatures emerging from cocoons, we have on the phone, I'm given to understand, and now we're suddenly having to rearrange and find headphones, our
errant hostess who is gallivanting about, and that is Elizabeth Anderson. Elizabeth, hello.
Hello, Philip. How are you?
I'm fine. I can only seem to hear you through other people's headphones, however, because I can't hear you through mine.
I'm curious, by errant, did you mean errant or arrant?
I'm assuming you said something that's amusing, and I was able to hear you say A and D.
That's okay. Enjoying the discussion is great.
Did you have any observations you'd like to add for us on this?
Just that you three are doing a wonderful job with critiquing the book, both the positives and the negatives, and I love the discussion of the Golem.
Thank you.
Well, so, yay.
Just wanted to say how much I enjoyed the show.
Well, thank you, and it's not over yet.
I know. I'm still listening.
It's so lovely to hear from you, and I'm sure the people who have been tuning in going, where's Elizabeth? Well, where in the world is Elizabeth San Diego?
I'm in D.C. at the Golden Crown Literary Society, but my friend Laura and I are listening to the show, so carry on.
Thank you so much, and we shall. Just a little thing from David here.
Yeah, it's so appropriate that you're with the Golden Crown, as we were talking about the League of the Golden Key.
True, yeah. David.
which in case we're back to. Thank you so much for calling, Elizabeth. It's lovely to hear your voice.
Lovely to hear yours.
Take care.
You, Brent and David. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So thank you for the loan of the headphones. So, okay, they've got a new character, too, very sexy, which the publisher is very pleased about, thinking that it'll make a lot of money to have that. However, there also becomes some discord with their publisher, who wants them to stop bashing Nazis so much. And so they try to... use that as leverage to get a better contract for themselves. And at the same time, there's also a legal problem that arises, which is that they are being sued for copying Superman too closely.
Yes.
And Superman, I think one of the things that they talk about in the book that really struck me, too, as a little moment, was when they talk about how is Clark Kent actually Jewish? Because nobody but a Jew would come up with a name like Clark Kent.
Don't even know.
You know, who can know? But that sort of leads into several problems that they're about to suffer as well. Because they begin feeling that they need to hide. Each of them has to hide some part of their identity in order to fit in. And I think that's something that resonated with, you know, my homo heart.
Right.
Because it was, you know, how much do I hide? How much do I expose? Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, I don't care anymore. But certainly in the time that we're talking about now, in the 40s and into the 50s, and, you know, for some people, even today.
Right.
They feel that they have to hide things about themselves in order to fit in and get along in society.
Right.
So another one of those things that really resonates.
The hiding and escaping, again.
Yes.
Just as a Luna moth escapes from its cocoon.
If everyone could just see you.
That's right.
Doing my Luna moth dance.
Yes, it's amazing.
Also at this time, they are able to realize having their escapist radio show. And we meet, in the course of this, Tracy Bacon, who is... as it says in the book, the world's largest piece of trafe. And then trafe is, of course, a Yiddish word, which means a food item's unclean and forbidden. The opposite of kosher, in other words, is trafe. And, of course, who is this character, Tracy? Bacon!
I love it.
Yes.
But I love bacon.
But, again, it's another one of those things that becomes... one of those big symbolic words.
Right, it's hitting you over the head with it.
Yeah.
Right.
Here's this thing you probably shouldn't have, but you're going to love it.
And again, I think he makes no apologies.
Right. He doesn't.
He's just putting it out there. It's as blatant as comic book characters.
You're right.
And I think he uses that throughout. I must say, I have not read any other of Chabon's works. So I don't know if he does this in other writing as well.
I can't say because I forget as soon as I read something, as we know. I don't have the mind for it.
So they are going on the League of the Golden Key.
Yes.
Which David had mentioned. Well, explain the League of the Golden Key since you brought it up.
Well, League of the Golden Key, as I recall, was this secret society that of which the escapist is a member. And he has his little team of support folks of various ethnic, heritage. And there is a long history of these members of the League of the Golden Key, and that you are empowered as the escapist, and that this had been passed on from Max Mayflower, the original escapist, to Tom Mayflower, who was able to throw down his crutches when he became the escapist and led this secret society. Yes.
And Mayflower, again, another one of those words. This is what America is all about, is the Mayflowers.
And the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the Golden Key becomes a physical reality when Joe gets a suit from Rosa. Rosa's father, actually, gives him a suit that has a golden skeleton key lapel pin.
Yes.
And he is going off to this reception, and he ties on his mask. And what happens? But a waiter sees him putting on his mask and cries out and runs from the ballroom. And that waiter is... Bom, bom, bom.
Carl Henry Ebeling, the saboteur.
His supervillain, his Moriarty, who suddenly comes in. And, of course, that night, he also had an unopened letter from his mother that he was carrying. And at the end of the night, he looks for it, and it's gone. Which is just sort of... And Ebeling, of course, had a bomb that Joe is able to, put in the diving helmet with Salvador Dali because he's able to solve all of these problems. He gets saved Salvador Dali. He was able to make the bomb not be a problem, prevent it from going off. And there is, there is a blast, but it's not as bad as it could have been. And that's when I think one of the most beautiful lines, there's several sentences and lines in this novel that just I'd have to stop and over. And that's where one of the most beautiful ones is, and it is, the true magic of this broken world lay in the ability of the things it contained to vanish, to become so thoroughly lost that they might never have existed in the first place. And that was just one of those moments where I just had to stop and go, oh, see, that's pretty. It does bring about some sighing.
Yes.
So Sammy begins a relationship of sorts with Bacon.
Yes.
Not very kosher.
Not kosher. No.
But then...
But tasty.
It also leads to other things, because one of the things that happens is that the actor, Bacon, pushes Sammy to move to Los Angeles with him. And Sammy... cannot admit that he is in love with Tracy Bacon.
Right.
But he thinks that Bacon loves him.
Yes.
At the same time.
Right.
That whole 40s closeted world.
It was fascinating, too. And we talked about this in the green room earlier, that the little bit of this story that was pretty gay or bisexual... it was well written and very, very interesting, but also like just a very short part of this very, very long book.
Yes.
I wanted it to be a little more gay.
Yes. That I would have liked that as well.
But it was also...
But I also think it was probably true because, like many, many relationships, I would assume, in a different time or even today's time, are wrought with heartbreak just because of the pressures of society at the time. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of not being able to admit that you love someone, that's hard.
Yeah.
So that was interesting, but very short.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, as you both have mentioned, it's something that we yearn for, is to see ourselves in these works of art.
Right.
And we want so badly to see our lives reflected in superheroes, in movies, you know, that one time that you finally see a woman who you can tell is supposed to be a lesbian. We finally find just a couple of pages, a couple of paragraphs that really affirm us.
Right.
As members of the LGBT community.
Indeed. And it did leave me wanting more of that. So Joe decides that he is going to actually propose to Rosa. And
that happened so quickly.
Yes.
Like, this is another one of those moments where I was, how did this happen? I'm very confused. Suddenly you're in love, and now you're in love with this man, and now you're engaged to this woman. I'm just very confused.
Well,
but you know me well enough, I get confused.
Yes, and of course, Sammy then, and this is one of the things that I'm glad that Chabon shines a little light on in this book. Sammy goes to a party, and of course, who's there? But Ruth Ebling!
Well, of course.
Because the whole Ebling family is out. It's like the sharks from Jaws. chase people through three movies. She's right there. But that's the way things are in comic book stories and melodrama stories.
It's part of storytelling, really.
She calls the police because it's a big gay party.
Mm.
And Sammy is able to not be arrested, but an FBI agent is able to track him down. And what happens to Sammy?
I feel like there are all these quizzes.
He is very much abused.
Yes.
By the FBI agent. And that happens.
Perhaps I had the abridged version and I didn't.
Yes.
Because I really don't remember the abuse.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sammy hid under the dinner table.
With someone else.
With someone else. And the FBI agent found him and dispensed his own form of justice.
Yes. Which happened. Frequently there were men who would go in to the police or to other things and say, look, this happened. This man beat me because I'm a homosexual. And they'd end up, you know, beating him themselves. Or sometimes there were rapes that occurred.
Mm.
It happened with homosexuals in the concentration camps as well. One of the last living former prisoners had been raped with a broomstick by his Nazi guards. And they just kept on doing it. It didn't matter to them. And I think that there's a certain parallel that Chabon is able to draw between Jews and their treatment in concentration camps, not mentioning the homosexual element in concentration camps, and the same abuse that was occurring through law enforcement in the United States at the same time.
Right, and I think he even talks specifically about the all of the there was a point where he goes on about all the things that were outlawed if you were Jewish in the home country of Joseph's home country, and really talking about all of these things. And then you think about the parallel is really just right there for you to take.
Yeah. That's one of the ones he doesn't make as clear.
Right.
As obvious, as blatant.
Maybe I prefer it to be a little...
You see, when you're able to put it together for yourself, it seems it's so much better. He doesn't make it quite so obvious that a golem is a clay man by changing the spelling of clay man.
Right. Not quite as obvious. Oh, one more non sequitur. You should mention the Wonder Woman thing you talked about in Break.
Yes. When Philip was talking about golems a little while ago, I remembered that the origin story of Wonder Woman shows
Wonder Woman.
Her... There you go.
Sorry.
Thank you. Shows her being crafted out of clay and brought to life. So even one of the great lesbian superheroes, one of the great role models to lesbians and to gay men. Your cue, Brent.
Wonder Woman. What are you saying? That's not true.
Just was originally a golem.
So back to
poor
the
Philip.
That's fine. I just wanted to overview a lot of the plot for people who might not know so much, so that they're able to keep up, that might not have read it, you know. Because then Joe goes to Antarctica and gets involved in a bursting appendix and survives by accident. And he ends up recuperating at Guantanamo Bay until the war is over.
Right.
And then we move into the final chapters of the book, where suddenly it jumps ahead about 14, 15 years. Someone has written a letter that's supposedly from the escapist, that he is going to jump off the Empire State Building, this big symbol of America, this place where their comic book offices were, this place that represents, it's even the name of their books, Empire Comics,
right.
That represents so much about America at that time, just as the World Trade Center meant in 2001 when he's getting all of these prizes for this novel. They're certain. It's kind of freaky deaky. Saying the escapist is going to jump off the building. And many people think that the person who is has written it and is going to be jumping is Joe Cavalier,
who they haven't seen for years at this point.
Right.
Because he went to the land of ice to serve during the war. And as Sammy goes into the office, he takes out the box that would contain the escapist costume that the great Trafe love of his life, Bacon, wore. And he finds that box is empty. There is no costume there.
Yes.
And so Sammy becomes very concerned. And it turns out to be something completely different going on there, which I want to leave a little mystery of the ending of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably for best.
For anyone who hasn't read it. We've got 4 minutes for reactions to the book. I know I'm not going to start with David, because I know what he has said about this book, and I want to kind of end on that. Mm-hmm. I will start off by saying I have very mixed feelings about this book. I think that it has a lot of strengths. There's a lot of strength in the writing. But there are some parts of it that I just had to keep forcing myself to go through. I'm much more engaged in it than the first time I tried to read it. And I got more into the plot and the story, which I think is a lot of fun. I think there are those sentences, those moments, one of which I used in the tagline for the show. Forget about what you're escaping from. Reserve your anxiety for what you are escaping to, which is said to be a saying in Prague. But overall, I would recommend this to. I know people who are very, very excited about it, and I would recommend this, but with provisos for people.
Right.
That they're going to be words that send you to the dictionary. Yeah, there's going to be moments where he seems to be showing off all of his research. So that's my reaction to it. Brent?
I would say it's a challenging read, but kind of like a good movie or a good book. I think if there's something that sticks with you and you're still thinking about parts of it, which this one really does stick with you, and in that way it is worth reading. But I will go with your little asterisk there, that just know that it isn't going to be the easiest read that you take on. But I think it'll stick with you, and you can have some fascinating, as you've heard, conversations about it. So I would give it, go read it.
One thumb up to one and a half?
Well, let's see. I would say 4 out of 5 thumbs.
Okay.
Figure that one out.
And the most unapologetic, unreserved response, I think, is David's.
This is one of my favorite books that I've ever read.
Oh, my goodness.
I love this book. I've told people many times that if I were to write a novel, this is the one I would want to write. In reading it, rereading it now, I was able to enjoy the prose a lot more. It was a lot easier to read because I didn't have to go through the hurdles of keeping track of all of this research, and I understand a lot of that history better than I did 12 or 15 years ago when I read the book the first time. So many beautiful sentences throughout the book. I enjoyed it, but I can certainly understand why people would have reservations.
Just as a couple of things, we talked about the film that they've been developing from this since it was written, since
I didn't know
it was published. They have been trying to make a film out of it, and it's been